I'm very happy now to welcome Eric Libby. He's an Omidyar Fellow at the Santa Fe Institute, and tonight he will be at the CCA, the Center for Contemporary Arts, introducing a special screening of the 1979 film Alien. It's part of the Science on Screen series, which is a collaboration between the Santa Fe Institute and the CCA. It's at 7 o'clock. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi, how's it going?
Good, good. I watched Alien last night. I decided to just watch the thing again because it's been a long time. Why did you choose this film?
Why did I choose Alien? Well, Alien is one of my favorite films in terms of horror and sci-fi, and I think that it stands up quite well. But particularly for Science on Screen, it's related to my own research in terms of parasites and life cycles and sort of thinking of foreign organisms and how they might have adapted to their environment or interact with humans. And so that's now is particularly important to me. But back then, of course, it was just the love of science fiction.
Right, and this giant, horrifying, scary creature. Does the creature in Alien, I mean, is it based on anything resembling terrestrial life?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. There are so many examples of parasites that do far worse things than what the alien does in this film. For example, bursting out of the gut is a very common way for parasites to leave their hosts, and some of them can be quite horrific. And in a weird way, it's something that when I've watched this in a new context, is that even the name of the film is kind of bizarre. I mean, if you're calling it Alien, but the humans are in space, and they encounter an organism they haven't seen before, arguably the humans are the aliens, right?
Right.
And in fact, what the organism is doing is something that is completely normal within the Earth context. And so there's nothing really alien about that. In fact, having an organism put on a spacesuit seems far stranger than having an organism needing to go through several hosts in order to complete a life cycle.
And so the life cycle of the alien in the movie is it finds a host. I mean, we have the Earthlings who are on this foreign planet who explore this thing, and of course amazing sets and symbolism and all this stuff in this movie, Ridley Scott. And then the eggs of the creature get into the human.
That's right. So the egg opens up and some nasty little crab-like squid thing jumps on the person's face and effectively then starts gestating within the human. And later on, as they take the human back, you burst out of him and takes on a new form. And later in other films, you realize that actually the life cycle is really fascinating because this organism not only goes through a human host and is a parasite, but in some ways it's also sort of a hive or social organism because the members that burst out of the humans will then go on to form a colony where they'll recruit other humans to gestate more, and they'll actually form a little protective area around the queen, which is something that the sequel Aliens actually investigates.
Very interesting. Yeah, you don't, in the movie Alien itself, you don't get so much of that. You've got this sort of one creature, and that's pretty much it.
Yeah, that's right. But each of the films actually addresses a different scientific concept and really expands the whole notion of what this sort of foreign organism does, right? The first one, it's basically the horrors of a parasite and some incredibly powerful alien creature. And the second one is looking at sort of the social aspects of this organism and how suddenly a colony of them might form. And in the third one, they even explore topics where some parasites can go through other hosts and change forms. And it's not necessarily their preferred host, but definitely they can infect others. And so it infects some cattle and it ends up taking a completely different form.
So let's talk for a moment about your work. We can come back to Alien in a minute if you want. But you study, among other things, the evolution of life from single-celled to multicellular organisms. I guess, if I understand correctly, the majority of the history of life on Earth is single-celled organisms, and the step to multicellularity is a big step.
Yeah, so part of that's correct. I mean, certainly single-celled creatures have been here for over 3 billion years and are the predominant form of life. But a lot of those single-celled creatures live in communities where they're sharing resources, and it's difficult to determine how many of those actually can live on their own, which is why so few of single-celled organisms we can actually take from their environment and culture in the lab. Most things aren't culturable, and the hypothesis is that they're not culturable, which means we can't grow them up in the lab, because they depend on other things in such an intricate way that we just don't understand it and can't provide them the resources they need. But multicellularity itself has evolved at least dozens of times that we know of, completely independently, and might have been hundreds or thousands for all we know. All we know are things that have made it successfully and live in, through the fossil record. And anyway, of these multicellular organisms, it allowed for a higher level complexity, like things that we are, that we can talk about this. But at the same token, you do have other creatures that exhibit complexity that aren't multicellular. I mean, single-celled creatures like E. coli that you can grow up in the lab are still very complex and do incredibly interesting things. And so my research often looks at how you go from single-celled creatures and how they can take some of this complexity and turn it into different things that we associate with complex multicellular life.
What are some of the interesting and complex things that, say, E. coli do?
Yeah, so E. coli, or at least other bacteria as well, who are single-celled, can form different states or different phenotypes. So in other words, they can look like they're completely different types. And one of these types might be susceptible to antibiotics and be fast-growing, and another one might be a slow-growing type and is not susceptible to antibiotics. And so they have to try to tune going between these two fast and slow forms, susceptible to antibiotics and resistant to antibiotics, in order to survive being in places like our bodies where we're constantly trying to kill them. And it's actually quite interesting how they coordinate that, because if you mistime it, you can lose out to other ones who have timed it quite well. But that same little aspect of just trying to figure out, I have two types, how do I go between them, is something that a lot of more complex organisms do. Algae do this, for example, many different forms, or even parasites, like the parasites in the movie, or just in general where they have multiple hosts and they have to try to figure out, as I go to each host and change forms, how often do I do this, when do I do this, and should I even do this? You know, is it possible that I could just, instead of being a parasite that goes through three hosts, why not just go through two?
How did they make those decisions? I mean, we tend to, when we talk about very small things, sometimes even when we talk about atomic and molecular particles, we sort of give them personalities.
Yeah,
like,
that's right.
I think I'll do this. And they're not thinking. I mean, they're one cell. How do they make their decisions?
No, that's right. And in fairness, it's something that makes it easier to talk about. But you're absolutely right. So they're not, as far as we know, they're not thinking about how they do these things. But instead, they evolve to have certain capacities, and then the environment might select for certain things to be better than others. So, for example, you might have an organism that switches between two types, and that's pretty good. And it's not doing it as well as it could, but doing it okay is fine. And as each mutation or each change causes it to do it slightly better, and that's selected, you end up having something that looks like it's making sophisticated decisions, but in fact, it's just using information from the environment, and it's encoded it in its genome so it can actually do these types of switchings. And these same switchings are what you see in developmental programs, right? I mean, you start with our bodies start with a single cell that's undifferentiated, and then suddenly, as it reproduces, it starts forming different types of cells that become different organs. None of them know the whole blueprint. All they know is a little small environment, and they're just following some sort of rule that, okay, if my neighbor is doing this, I'm going to do that, and you end up with things like livers, hearts, and kidneys.
So when we talk about these little cells that are swimming around in the water, and as you say, many of them are in such a complex relationship with their environment that you can't culture them in a laboratory. I mean, there's an individual cell, but there's also a community, and that it brings up real questions of what is an individual? I mean, like, is an apple an individual, or is the apple tree? Is a human being an individual? I mean, politically we are, socially we are, but we can't survive independently for very long, and we certainly can't reproduce ourselves. So, like, this concept of individuality is really complex.
Yeah, for sure. And some of my colleagues at SFI, or the Santa Fe Institute, and I are trying to come up with rules or at least algorithms for determining what the biological individual is. I think a lot of what's been used before is just sort of ad hoc, this looks like an individual, I see the apple tree and I'll call that an individual because I'm interested in how many apple trees I have. And that worked for a while, but then when you have different questions, you might need different notions of what the individual is. And so we're really looking at an idea where, depending on what questions you want answered, might determine what type of individuals, these are in quotes, that you would need to define. And so a good example of this might be, if you go up to the mountains above Santa Fe, you'll see this aspen grove, right? And aspens are this classic example within biological individuality because they often share a common root system. And so you could say, well, the entire forest is one organism that has just different cell types or organs, and those organs have to be trees, happen to be trees. Or you could say that each aspen tree individually or on its own is an own individual and it's separate. And it really depends on your question. I mean, if you're interested in questions of biodiversity, then probably the aspen forest is just one individual. But if you're interested in terms of space or how much wood you can get, or you know, any number of other questions that you might be interested in, it's possible that the aspen trees themselves might be considered an individual for some purposes. And so for us, it's really important to ask the question first, and then based on that question, try to come up with a systematic way for defining what individual you should be concerned about, and not going the other way, not saying, I need some absolute definition of an individual, and then I can answer all of my questions. And it really plays on this boundary between ecology and evolution, right? Ecology is very much about the interactions between different organisms, and evolution tends to look at changes in populations, but we tend to look at a single population, a population of one type, like the number of, you know, green apples or something like this. So really what you're saying, which is a great viewpoint, is that there's a lot of things that play between here, right? That you can't just look at the individual, an organism on its own. You really have to consider the context, but you also need to think of its population changing and how that influences others. And there's a whole field in this that the buzzword is eco-evolutionary feedback, and there's a lot of other topics that are looking at very similar issues.
Eco-evolutionary feedback. Ladies yeah. and gentlemen, use this in a sentence today as you go out into your day. The question of, I was just thinking, well, if all the aspen trees in the aspen forest, are they genetically identical?
So they're genetically very, very similar. I'm very hesitant about saying identical because even in our own bodies, there are cells that have mutated right. and are cancerous. And so we're not really genetically homogeneous either. I mean, once you get a certain number of cells, you start getting variations in the cells. And so there are subtle differences, but certainly if I were to take an aspen tree here and compare it to one in, say, Albuquerque or somewhere else where you might find an aspen tree, it's going to be very different and much more different than you would find them here next to one another.
So let's go back to the question of the evolution of multicellular organisms. What do we know about that? What are the questions that you all are pursuing?
What do we know about it? And what questions are we pursuing?
Yeah.
Those are great questions in and of themselves. But actually, there's a couple different ways that you can go at this. So the historical way is that you would take modern organisms and you try to construct phylogenetic trees or evolutionary trees and go backwards in time and look at the fossil record and try to figure out how things happened. And that's one way, and that's very valid, and you can use that to understand how multicellularity evolved on Earth. My colleagues and I, so I work with a group at Georgia Tech, and I work with a group in New Zealand and a group in Washington and Montana. We're trying to do it from a bottom-up approach where we take single-celled organisms and try to evolve multicellularity in a lab. And then by doing that, we can try to understand how easy it is for multicellularity to evolve and what you need for it to evolve. So, for example, my colleague Will Ratcliffe was working in a group with Micah Trevisano, and they evolved multicellularity in a single-celled yeast. So what they did is, it's really simple. They took this yeast and they grew it up in like a little beaker, and after a few days, they spun the beaker. And so the way it works is that if you happen to be bigger, you fall faster. Okay. And then so what they did is they picked from the very bottom of the beaker, and then they put it in a new beaker and repeated the process. And what happened was in a very short amount of time, so just days, the unicellular yeast evolved into big multicellular clumps. They're called snowflake yeast. So they look like these little snowflake-type patterns. And this evolved with relative ease, and all it took was a single mutation for this to happen. And since then, he's been growing them in the lab, continuing the same process, and they've started to evolve into different types of looking snowflakes, and they've evolved many other traits afterwards. So they evolved strangely different cell shapes. They actually changed the way they connect to other cells. And so in some ways, what we're looking at is the evolution of a development of an organism. It's changing its shape and form to perform better and better and better in this environment. It's trying to be more fluid dynamic in terms of falling much faster depending on its size and getting better at reproducing. And so it's actually really impressive.
Now, can you say accurately that that evolution was a response to the environmental conditions?
Yeah, so in a way we can, because we can remove the pressure to fall faster. So you can just grow it into a beaker and then not spin it, but just take from anywhere in the beaker and do the same process. And if you do that long enough, you'll eventually lose the multicellularity and the organism will go back to its unicellular form.
That's so interesting. So what does that tell you? What can you extrapolate from that example?
I think that it tells you that life is incredibly plastic. And in some ways, we have a hypothesis that might address these issues, which is if you want multicellularity to stay multicellularity and not go back to unicellularity, you need to evolve these secondary traits or these later traits that ratchet you into multicellularity and make it much harder to go back. So, for example, a good example of this would be what's known as reproductive division of labor or the germ soma split. It just means that in a multicellular organism, some cells get to reproduce and form new organisms and others don't. So in our bodies, right, the sperm and the egg get to produce new humans, whereas our nose cells and our ear cells, I'm looking at you, so I'm just picking random parts of you, don't get to participate in this process. And that makes it much harder for your nose just to walk off and form a new person, right? Because it doesn't have that ability anymore. And so in some ways, this type of division of labor makes it harder to go back, and it ratchets you in.
We're talking to Eric Libby, believe it or not, about the film Alien. No, we're talking about his work at the Santa Fe Institute. So when you go, you've got these single cells, these yeast cells, then you have this environment where there's pressure for them to evolve into multicellular organisms that adapt better to their environment. And then pretty soon you've got vertebrates. I mean, it seems like each step is really big and an incredibly, what we might call in human language, a very creative process.
So the leap from these snowflake yeast to vertebrae is, when you said soon,
yeah.
I mean, we're talking millions
of years,
right?
Years,
I mean,
yes. Like,
based on my lifespan, that's long.
Yeah.
I think that you can call it a creative process, but I think it's something like, and I mean, there are definitely people at SFI that look at these topics of innovation, especially within cultural, technological, or biological. Sometimes it's really hard if you just look at something like, once again, I'm staring at you and your computer, but you have a computer, right? And looking at that and thinking about where we were 200 years ago or 300 years ago, that seems amazing. But it's been a whole bunch of little things that have been used and put together to create something that's incredibly complex, that is really difficult for us to assemble on our own without all these specialized labor and different technologies that we've combined. And I think biology is doing the same thing in some sense. I mean, it's developing little things that are adaptive at each stage. And then eventually, you know, you can get some very fortunate events where sometimes you have two things that are separate and you connect them. And it could be a mutant that is horrific and dies right away. But sometimes it gives you something that's completely novel and lets you do something completely new. And more adaptations take that farther or further. And it's much harder to go back and say, well, how did that happen from something without understanding all these little steps that led you there? Which is why the bottom-up approach for us in the evolution of multicellularity seems like an easier way to go, because it's somehow much easier to start with something that you believe to be relatively simple and see how it adds each little step of complexity, instead of taking something now and trying to work backwards and figure out what the important steps were. And there are people who are doing this, and it works really well for them. It just, my mind can't handle this. Like, I see something like an algae and it's just impossible for me to understand it. I need to take something that's even as simple as a bacteria, which is still very complex, and then try to go the other way.
And also, I would think that the fossil record, while a very fabulous tool for understanding, is not complete. It's not going to just give you every textbook step that you want.
Yeah, it's not particularly good with small squishy things made mostly of water that
right.
are microscopic. Those things don't tend to fossilize as well as, say, dinosaurs, so it's difficult to get a lot of these intermediate forms. I mean, you can also think of it, too, that we're still discovering incredibly new and very interesting microorganisms that are living today. let alone how many of those that have died in the past that we just have absolutely no record of because we haven't dug them up yet, or right. they never were there, you know, in terms of the fossil record.
So when you think about the evolution of multicellularity and ever-increasing division of labor, like your nose cells smell and your ear cells hear and all
you're
the other things
me,
that we do.
You're looking at me, this is where it's coming from.
Just like what you were saying. And then you look at what human communities do, and we have separated ourselves into societies where there's a lot of division of labor. Do you, I mean, we non-scientists always see analogies like that. Do you think of those things as being similar processes of evolution?
So I don't think that being a non-scientist matters at all in that. I think that what you've just described is an entire area of research that is called major transitions or levels of selection research. And we actually just had a working group at SFI, or Santa Fe Institute, look at this. And the notion is that at different levels, so I can take inside the cell, I could take single-celled, I could take multicellular organisms, I can take communities of multicellular organisms, like cultures or societies, and that as long as it's an evolutionary process and things are allowed to reproduce and there's variation and selection, that I should be able to see similar things at different scales. And I think that to somehow that's an incredibly profound and sort of sexy idea, isn't it? I mean, that what I'm seeing at the human level should have in some way some equivalent at lower levels. I use lower just meaning kind of single
smaller,
cell. Yeah, that's right, smaller. And I think that that's something that for me is a real driving force in my research, because I do really well with trying to think of generalities and things that should hold not just in the world that we have now, but the world that we used to have and other worlds as well, that these processes are incredibly general and should be able to produce similar things. And we should be able to understand that in some way.
Eric Libby is an Omidyar Fellow at the Santa Fe Institute. And once again, he will be at the CCA tonight introducing a special screening of the film Alien, which was made in 1979, Sigourney Weaver at the age of 30, some amazing actors in it, Harry Dean Stanton is in it, and John Hurt.
There's also Ian Holm.
Right.
That's right. Bilbo Baggins as a robot, which is fantastic.
Yeah, it's definitely a blast from the past, shall we say, but, you know, pretty good film. Starts at 7 o'clock, so you'll be doing question and answers at the end. You'll be introducing the film at the beginning?
That's right. I do a very brief little introduction, and then we'll stick around and answer whatever questions that I can.
Excellent. Well, Eric Libby, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe, and we'll see you at the CCA tonight.
That sounds great. Thank you for having me.